Hello, everyone. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of the Tate School, the Masoret Harav. This is that by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs of Great Britain, which was also recently put out as a new sitter. It's a great brand, great fanfare, but they have inserted anthologized commentary of Rabbi Soloveitchik on the sitter. Of course, the Rav didn't write a commentary on the sitter. The editors of the volume have put together, culling from the different writings and teachings, different things that he said about the davening, to put it together as a commentary on the sitter. It's a great resource for those of you that are interested in these topics, and I imagine if you're listening right now, you are interested in the topic. I'm not sure that I'll make direct use of it in the course, but it's a very good resource to have, and it's a worthy addition to your library. So there's a link to it. You can get it in Jewish bookstores around the world, on Amazon, elsewhere, etc. Another programming note. Thank you to all of you that have been joining us live, or that joined us live last week and this week. I'm glad that some of you on the East Coast of the United States have electricity and are able to join us, and we hope that you're dry and safe and warm, weathering the storm, as they say. And those of you that are not able to join us live but will be listening to the archives, we're glad you were able to get your heads above water to do so. I did notice during the week that very many people downloaded the archives. I think even more people downloaded the archives than attended live, and we had a very nice attendance last week. So if you are listening to Shiur by recording, because for whatever reason you're unable to join us live, welcome to you as well. I look forward to hearing your comments. I know some of you, I know I'm speaking to the distant future, some of you may be listening to this not synchronous to the ongoing unfolding of the course, but might be listening in a year from now. These classes are being recorded in October, November, December 2012. If you're listening to this at some point in the distant future, well, I'll welcome your comments then as well. I've put my email in the chat box, but it's Jeffrey Sachs, JeffreySacks at gmail.com. Now, one of the interesting things about teaching on Web Yeshiva is that this happens not infrequently, that people will download a whole course or listen to an archived shiur that we teachers may have delivered 3 or 4, now even 5 years ago, and you'll get the occasional email, and of course it's very flattering that anyone there has a question for us, and it's even more flattering the idea that someone anticipates that we remember what it is that we said 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. But we try to help wherever possible. So if you're listening by the archives, we welcome your feedback, your comments, your questions as well, particularly from those of you that are kind of following along just a day or so behind the live class, because sometimes your insights or your questions can then be incorporated in the next live shiur, and then I guess you'll hear that a day or so later when you get that on the archives. So welcome to you all. And thank you to all of you that participated live and also contributed a lot to the conversation, both in the live session as well as in the few emails that I got during the week. Last week we had a bit of an introduction to the role of tefillah in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, and I made mention of the Rav's grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, whose work on the Rambam, on Maimonides, led to a very important insight to an apparent contradiction between two things in the Rambam's Hilchot Tefillah. In the fourth chapter of Hilchot Tefillah, the Rambam appears to say that Kavanat Halev, that intention in prayer, and again, to be clear, by prayer here we're talking about the Amida, the silent worship, the Shmona Esrei, the standing prayer, all of these different nicknames for the main thrice daily prayer. These conversations at this point are limited to that particular prayer, the highlight of the of the davening, that kavana, intent, focus in prayer is required in the entirety of the prayer. All 19 blessings of the Shmona Esrei. I trust that many of you catch the irony there, that the Shmona Esrei, the 18 blessings, actually have 19, this one was added, all of them, and all of them require kavana. If we were to tune out for just a moment, at any point during the however many minutes it takes us, hey, that's one thing I didn't get. I gave a challenge. How many words are there in the weekday Shmona Esrei? I didn't get an answer from that from anyone. So the contest is still open. Maybe we'll even send a prize. But for however many minutes it takes one to daven the Amidah, even if you tune out for just 2 seconds, you are absent the state of v'yireh atzmo ki'ilu hu omed lefnei ha'shechina, of envisioning yourself as if you are standing in front of the Divine Presence. All right, so Miriam asks whether we're davening Nusach Sfarim or Nusach Ashkenaz. There probably would be a number of words difference, but I'll accept either answer. I'll accept either answer. I don't know the answer. I'm curious. I wanted someone to do the work for me. I assume it's possible to do. As a matter of fact, there's probably a very easy way to do it, and I'm sure that within the frame of this shiur, someone could go online, find an online text of the Amidah, and put it into a Word document, and then just do word count, and you get at least a rough guess. So whether you're saying Mashiach Baruch Mirid Goshem or not, you know, would have to be taken into account. But even with all of those differences, you know, we get a rough count. So that necessity to have focus and intent of God awareness of the sense that you're standing before the King, that's required for the entirety of the tefillah. There's a story, I just recounted the story to my children. There's a story that Rav Moshe Feinstein apparently used to tell. I believe it's in that old art scroll biography of Rav Moshe, which despite its hagiographic components is worth reading because it's really quite inspiring. If it's there, I read it, over 25 years ago, so don't hold me to it. But the story goes something like this, that Rav Moshe was the realm of a small town in Europe, and one day the Russian army came marching through, a small platoon or unit of the Russian army came marching through. That was never good news. That the Russian army should come marching through your little shtetl. And this time, instead of coming to beat up on the Jews, the commander was angry at the troops for something they had done. And to punish them, he marches them into town, stands them up in file, in formation in the town square, and he makes them stand at attention. And he tells them, oy vey to any of you that even blinks an eye. And they stood at attention, feet together, arms at the side, I'm at this point I'm just making up the story, but something along the lines of, you know, they stood for hours, and let's make the story even better and say it was in the rain. Moshe says the Jews, you know, they basically stayed indoors because they knew that there'd be no good would come out of their being involved in this. But he says something along the lines of he remembers looking out the window to watch this and thinking that that's you understand what it means that when we daven the Amidah, you stand almost at attention with your feet together. You know, some people have this habit of shuckling, although in some rabbinic positions that's discouraged. Some people find shuckling aids their kavanah, but in fact, if you're standing at attention in front of the in front of the king or the king of kings, you know, one doesn't chuckle. You stand ramrod straight at attention. It's not a halachic matter about chuckling, but some people think that it might be proper to stand more at attention. Although one imagines that if chuckling, rocking back and forth, aids your kavana, then more power to you. So that idea of that sense of standing before the king or standing before the commander with fear and trepidation and focus and et cetera, that there's something to be, there was something about that, witnessing that experience that left an impression on him. So the first passage in the Rambam seems to say you need kavana for the whole thing. The second passage in the Rambam seems to say that v'im kiven et libo bevracha rishona shuv eino tzarech. That ideally, l'chatchila, one should have kavana for the entirety of the prayer, but b'dieved, ex post facto, in reality, if you at least could muster up kavana for the first of the 19 brachot, shuv eino tzarech, then you're off the hook. You fulfilled your obligation. Some explain the difference between the two passages in the Rambam as one is talking about an ideal and one is talking about a reality. One is what we should strive for, and the other is when we're examining the situation, once it's happened, we try to determine whether or not one has fulfilled his obligation or one hasn't fulfilled his obligation. If somebody stands up to pray and they skip every other word, then the halacha would say he hasn't prayed. It's definitionally what he said was not a prayer. If he stands up to pray and he, instead of taking a siddur off the shelf, he grabbed a different book and he ends up, you know, reciting the Declaration of Independence, well, we wouldn't say that he prayed. It wasn't a prayer. So the question is, when we evaluate the act having had been done, once it's complete, do we say it's not the best way, but it is in fact a prayer, or do we say it wasn't even a prayer? So that seems to be the simplest way to explain the contradiction in the Rambam. It's not a contradiction. One is talking about an ideal, and the other is talking about how we evaluate a less than ideal reality. Jason asked a question about an earlier point in the Rambam, which I mentioned last time, about the necessity of washing one's hands. One's hands need not be washed with a cup three times, although some people are stringent to do so. The point here is that your hands should be clean. So if your hands, in fact, are clean, if you've washed them under running water, that's sufficient. And ideally, one should wash one's hands before he prays. Reb Chaim, the Rav's grandfather, examines this contradiction in the Rambam, and he lays down some fundamental ideas about prayer, which we will now explore. So first, he spells out this contradiction, and then Reb Chaim says the following. Instead of explaining the Rambam by saying that it's talking about, you know, two sides of the same coin, that it's one is the ideal and one is the reality, he says that really these are two different halachot, saying two different things about Kavanah, because there are in fact two categories of Kavanah. Again, I just remind you, Kavanah is this key word for all of these ideas of intent in prayer, focus in prayer. There are two types of Kavanah, and each one has its own regulations. One type of Kavanah is required 100%. And the other, although it would be good if we had kavana for the whole thing, the other type of kavana we can manage with a lower amount. One type of kavana is perush hadvarim, understanding the meaning of the words. I'm not here going to go into the topic of praying in other languages. I think most people are probably familiar with the idea that ideally one should pray in Hebrew. If one prays in any language that they understand, you fulfill your obligation, according to almost all poskim. However, it's preferable to daven in Hebrew. It may even be preferable to daven in Hebrew if you have only a partial understanding than to daven in your native language with presumably full comprehension. That may have something to do with the inherent problems of any translation or some other matters, but certainly Hebrew is preferred. So the understanding of the meaning of what you're saying, v'soda hudin kavana, v'shenit shichavein shehu omeid b'tfila lifnei Hashem. So one type of kavana is to understand what you're saying. The other is to be conscious that you are standing before God. That is what the Rambam is talking about in the first passage, where he says, "Umahi kavana." The knowledge, the awareness that you're standing in front of God, that, technically speaking, is not really what we mean by kavanah. Kavanah, you know, we have this idea, there's a topic in the Gemara about mitzvot srichot kavana, mitzvot einam srichot kavana. The Gemara asks whether or not in the performance of mitzvot, forget about prayer for a second, think of any other mitzvah you do. The masa, the lulav, the shofar, those are always the great examples. That in any mitzvah you do, whether or not you are required to have kavana, some kind of intent. Generally speaking, there may be exceptions. There are exceptions to this. Generally speaking, we say mitzvot einan srichot kavana. Mitzvot do not require kavana. It's good to have kavana. It's good to have special focus and intent, but it's not necessary. So, for example, the lulav. As long as you don't have negative kavana, as long as you don't specify, you pick up the lulav and its robe on Sukkot. As long as you don't specify that you don't intend to fulfill your obligation, beyond that, you don't need kavana. That being said, one needs to be aware that what he's picking up, or she's picking up, is in fact a lulav and etrog, and perhaps that today is Sukkot. I'll come back to that in a second. The awareness that you're standing before God is mi'etzem ma'ase hatfilah. It's not some kind of added focus or intent or awareness. It is, in fact, definitional to what prayer is. Etzem ma'aseh hatfilah. Awareness that you're standing before God is the definition of prayer. Just like the case that I mentioned last week that some of you emailed me your thoughts on, the etrog. You have to take an etrog, a lulav, an etrog, on Sukkot. If instead of an etrog, you took a lemon, or an orange, or a watermelon, or a tennis ball, you would not fulfill the obligation of lulav and etrog. Not because you took a pasul etrog, but because you didn't take an etrog at all. Definitionally, you weren't even in the right ballpark. The maaseh ha-mitzvah, the mitzvah act, requires there's a certain definition. Without a lulav, we can't say that you ate a lulav, you shook a lulav. Without a matzah, we can't say that you ate a matzah. If you blow a kazoo as nicely as possible on Rosh Hashanah, it ain't a shofar. Definitionally, you haven't even done the mitzvah act. Ve'im ein libo panui ve'im roe atzmo she'omed l'vnei Hashem u'mitpalel ein ze maaseh ha'tfilah. If you say the words absent the awareness that you're communicating with the divine, you haven't prayed. V'harei hu bechlal mit'asek. Mit'asek is a category in halacha. In Hebrew, the word, the Hebrew root, ayin samech kuf, osek, la'asok, asuk, means to be busy, to be occupied. And the concept of mit'asek is antithetical to the idea of ma'aseh. Ma'aseh means an act with intent. Ma'aseh means the act the way it's supposed to be done. So even though you could have two people standing next to each other in shul, each one stands at the same time, each one faces the same direction, each one puts his or her feet together, each one bows at the same time, each one ends at the same time, each one in fact says the same words at the same pace. Maybe they even shuckle in rhythm. If the first person is aware that he's standing before God, he has in fact performed the mitzvah act. If the other fellow, who externally looks like he's a carbon copy of the first one, a mirror, a carbon image, if in fact he's absent that awareness that he is omed l'fnei Hashem, he has not done the mitzvah act, even though objectively it appears that they've done the same thing. Mit'asek means to be, almost like to be fooling around. Sometimes when you're fooling around, something else happens as a consequence. So, for example, take the opposite case. Not when you're trying to perform a mitzvah, but sometimes, by accident, you commit a sin. On Shabbat, min ha-Torah, according to the Torah, the forbidden activities on Shabbat, the malachot, are not merely creative acts. They are melechet machshevet, intentional acts, acts with a certain amount of machshava, thought, invested in them. So we all know that if somebody is running down the hall of their house and they brush up against the light switch and they turn the lights off or they turn the lights on, that is called shogeg. It's accidental. It's not good. We're not going to give you a pat on the back for it. But it's not an intentional act. You were mitasek. You were fooling around. You were playing a game of you were tossing around a Nerf ball in the house on Shabbat, and it bumped into the light switch again. Right. So you were mitasek. You can't say it's like somebody who goes and intentionally commits a violation of Shabbat, because it doesn't rise to the level of intentionality. Well, similarly, just like we can perform averot, we can perform sins by accident, well, we can also perform mitzvot by accident. So go back to the case of the lulav and the etrog. A bird flies into the house. A bird flies into your sukkah on the first morning of Sukkot, and you wanna shoo it out of the sukkah. So you grab a broom and you're waving the broom at the bird to get it out. But it wasn't a broom. You thought it was a broom. In fact, you picked up a lulav and esrog, and you did the the motions of shaking the lulav and esrog. It would look to the outside observer like you were doing the mitzvah. And in fact, we know that all that's required to fulfill the mitzvah of the lulav and esrog is not even all the shaking, the up, up, down, down, right, left, all around. Really all one needs to do is to pick up the lulav and etrog, which is why we have this problem. Most people have this custom of holding the etrog upside down. That when you pick up the lulav and etrog in order to say the bracha on it, well, just picking it up, you've already fulfilled the obligation. So once you've already fulfilled the obligation, you can no longer recite the blessing, which has to be recited prior to fulfilling the mitzvah. So the practice is to pick up the lulav and etrog with the lulav upside down, because when it's upside down, you can't fulfill the obligation. It can only be fulfilled when it's right side up. So you have it, you're ready to go. You recite the blessing, and then you turn the lulav, you turn the esrog right side up, and bing, you've done the mitzvah. And then our custom is to add all of the shakings and all of the different directions. So if you were to pick up that lulav and chase the bird out, and in fact perform the ritual completely devoid of kavanah, so devoid of kavanah that you were merely mitasek, that almost by accident, as a byproduct of doing something else, in a Rube Goldberg kind of way, you ended up doing the mitzvah act. It's not a mitzvah act. It's merely mitasek. You were preoccupied. You were doing something else. Ein bo maaseh. Even though objectively to the outside observer, it looks like you did. But a normal person who picks up the lulav and esrog with awareness that it's a mitzvah, beyond that, we don't require special kavanah. Let me just look at the chat here. No, so it's true that Sherry asks this question about the etymology of mitasek, and it is similar to la'asok b'divrei Torah, to be occupied b'divrei Torah. But here in the halachic context, it means something without intention. In the bracha, the blessing of la'asok b'divrei Torah, that we should be occupied with Torah, well, there you could say a drasha. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure Rabbi Soloveitchik does say this drasha, although I can't recall where he says it. But that's the point of the bracha, that Torah is both our vocation and our avocation. It occupies us both consciously and subconsciously. And there are actually many stories that demonstrate how this took place in his life, but I'm not gonna go into that right now. Since the awareness that you're standing before God is definitional to the mitzvah, al kein ma'akevet kavanazu b'chol atzilah. Its absence, the absence of standing before God, is required for the whole thing. And its absence, even for a portion of the tzilah, would be ma'akev, to use the Rambam's term. It would invalidate, it would prevent the fulfillment of the mitzvah if it was missing at any point, even for 1% of the tefillah. Tiba makom shehaya mitasek, dino kilo hitpalel klal. Ki'ilu dileg milot eleh. You're davening, you have kavanah. Someplace in the seventh bracha, you tune out for three words. It's as if you skipped those words. And having skipped those words, you've invalidated the entire tefillah. The question about Shema, we're going to hold off on the question about Jason's question about Shema. I'm going to hold off on that, because it's not clear that the entirety of the Shema is min haTorah. And in all cases, here we're talking about, I mentioned this last time, here we're talking about fulfilling our obligation to pray on the rabbinic level when we daven according to what Chazal demand of us, we fulfill the Torah obligation plus the larger superstructure that Chazal have superimposed on it. It seems, according to most opinions, Shema, the first pasuk, maybe the first paragraph, are min haTorah. So if one was ill and not able to say the entire Shema, but could at least say either the first paragraph or minimally the first pasuk, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, you would fulfill a Torah obligation, which is, of course, desirable in the absence of being able to fulfill the larger or the more encompassing rabbinic obligations that surround it as well. But Shema and Tefillah are two different things, as I've mentioned. V'halo v'adai deli inyan etzem haTefillah kol yud tet brachot. All 19 brachot are required. V'rak hecha shemechavenu makir ma'asa v'yodeh shehu omed b'tefillah ela she'eno yodeh perush hadvarim sheze din misuyam rak b'tefillah levad hosef adin kavana. Why is the absence of kavana, why does the absence of even a drop of kavana, the type of kavana, the larger kavana, the kavana that you're standing in the presence of God, why does that invalidate the tefillah, even if you're only missing 1% of it? Because it's definitional to what the mitzvah is. If you have 99% of a Sefer Torah, the Torah has many thousands of letters in it. But if the Torah is missing letters, it's invalid, and it needs to be repaired. You know, this happens from time to time. Someone gets up to read the Torah, someone's called up for an aliyah, and they're reading, and then suddenly they find that either a word has gotten smudged or rubbed out or worn out, or you find that there was a mistake there that had been there from day one, and apparently on all previous readings, no one had noticed it. The word is missing a letter. Sometimes even a whole word is missing. Now it's harder for that to happen because they have these computer scans that check. For throughout history, relied on human proofreading, which is of course fallible. But the computer, you can never trick the computer. So they have these big scanners that they can run the whole Torah through, and it checks and it finds if something is missing with a very high degree of accuracy. But sometimes this will happen. If a letter is missing from the Sefer Torah, the whole Torah is pasul, is invalid, and needs to be repaired. So the same thing with tefillah. If one word is missing the kavanah that you're standing before God, it knocks down the whole tower, comes tumbling down. That is definitional to what it is. A Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll that's missing a word, is not a Torah. I mean, it still has sanctity, but it's not a kosher Torah. A tefillah that is missing even one word imbued with that awareness that it is part of the communication that we have when we're standing before the divine is definitionally like shaking a lemon instead of shaking an etrog, blowing a kazoo instead of blowing the shofar. But it's not actually kavana in the conventional sense. It's the other type of kavana. In other words, there is kavana that we should have when we blow the shofar or shake the lulav or eat the matzah or any other mitzvah. This is not that type of kavanah. This is the definition. The kavanah that one should have when he blows the shofar is extra. You should have it. It's good to have it. It's good to think holy thoughts. But beyond the awareness that this is a shofar and today is Rosh Hashanah, beyond that, it's all extra. It's not inherent to the mitzvah of shofar. It's an additional layer, the absence of which does not invalidate the performance of the mitzvah. By prayer, the awareness that you're standing before God is not additional, an additional ideal to strive for. It is, in fact, the very definition of what a prayer is. Oh, so Phil asks a good question. Only someone from Vermont could ask a question like this. How can one be sure they are attaining that level of intention in prayer? That's a good question, but I'm not going to answer that now. We're going to need some more time to unravel that. But it's whatever it means that we're standing before God, that awareness is what's to be strived for. I'll hope you won't mind if I give away the ending now and tell you not everyone agreed with Reb Chaim. And part of the reason that not everyone agreed with Reb Chaim was it seems that he's setting the bar very high. Not that people thought it wasn't a high bar that we should all strive for, but it seems to be a high bar that not everyone can obtain. I'm only speaking about myself, of course. I know some of you have a lot of kavanah. We're still talking about Reb Chaim. This is the Reb's grandfather speaking. We haven't gotten to Rabbi Soloveitchik himself yet. באמת גם בדין כוונה שני דינים יש בזה. אחד הדין כוונה שמכוון לעשות המצווה. So when you do a mitzvah, you have to have kavana that you're doing a mitzvah. And if you think you're chasing the bird out of the sukkah, you're not having the intention that you're doing a mitzvah, so you don't fulfill anything. And that's required for everything. The minimal awareness that what you're doing is a mitzvah, that's always required. Because the absence of that minimal awareness puts you in the category of mitasek. If you're not even aware that what you're doing is a mitzvah, that's probably the reason that Chazal instituted brachot. That before a mitzvah, or before almost every mitzvah, there are exceptions to this, we pause and we say, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu leshev basuka v'shmoa kol shofar al achilat matzah. That's the point of the brachot that are formulated, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu. That we pause and we make a declaration that what I'm about to do is a mitzvah. That what I'm about to do is the fulfillment of an obligation. Because that awareness, now that everyone knows that if one doesn't recite a bracha, that the brachot are all rabbinic. That the rabbis added this extra requirement that before you do a mitzvah, you recite a blessing. And it seems likely if we were to skip that blessing and you forget the blessing and you didn't know the blessing and you did the mitzvah anyway, you 100% fulfill the mitzvah. You've just neglected to fulfill the additional, the accompanying rabbinic obligation to pause and say a blessing beforehand. But apparently the point of those blessings, the Shekhin Shonav Mitzvah Tavit Sivanu, are to pause to declare that minimal awareness that what I'm about to do is in fact a mitzvah and not house cleaning the birds out of the sukkah, not playing on my kazoo. You may be aware of the sugya in Masechet Rosh Hashanah. It's a mishnah actually, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, that deals with the interesting case of. You're walking. It happens to be Rosh Hashanah morning, or maybe it's Purim, and you're walking in the alley behind the shul, and through the window you hear either a shofar or you hear the Megillah, meaning you haven't gone to shul. You go to shul on Rosh Hashanah morning, so it seems clear that you're there to hear the shofar. But here you're a mere passerby, but you hear the shofar. How much kavanah do you need to have? So if you hear a sound and you think it's a donkey braying or a dog barking, but in fact it was a shofar, so you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Because even though technically the sound entered your ear, if you thought it was a dog barking or a donkey braying instead of the shofar blowing, so you're lacking in at least the minimal awareness that what you're doing is a mitzvah. But beyond that, that's the kind of kavanah that's required when we say mitzvot srichot kavanah. That minimal awareness that you're performing a mitzvah act, but holy deep thoughts, standing before God, communicating with the divine, Kabbalistic intentions, that's not required. As a matter of fact, that's why the Misnagdim, the Lithuanian school, the anti-Hasidic, the anti-mystical model, was not to recite those supplementary petitions. You know, sometimes in the Siddur you'll see before certain mitzvot, I know they have it in the Sukkah and by the Lulav, if you look in the Siddur you'll find these Yehi Ratzons, these kinds of like prayers that we say where we ask God that the mitzvah that we're about to do, that in all of its important meanings and symbolisms, and it should all be fulfilled, and I should get what's coming to me, and etc. So some people recite those Yehi Ratzons. You know, sometimes there's a Yehi Ratzon that's recited after candle lighting that many women say. That seems to be a different type of thing. That's more of a bakasha, where we ask that at the time of candle lighting that all good things should happen to us. But the other types of Yehi Ratzons that are recited before mitzvot, or the Hineni Muchanim Zuman, this declaration that I'm about to perform a mitzvah. Many people know because there's a little ditty to it that we sing before Sfirat Omer. Hineni Muchanim Zuman, Hineni Muchanim Zuman, etc., etc. So the Litvish school omits all of those because it's redundant to the bracha. The bracha that we say, Asher Kedishana B'mitzvah V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer, that is the declaration that Hineni Muchanim Zuman L'Kayem Mitzvot Aseh, because I'm declaring that I am mitzuveh and I am doing my obligation. But nevertheless, many people do recite those Hineni Muchan, or Yehi Ratzon, etc. Uveze in chiluk bein bracha rishona v'shar hatzila. The awareness that you're standing before God, the definitional awareness, is true for the entirety of the mitzvah. It doesn't matter whether the first word in the Torah is missing, or the last word in the Torah is missing, or one of the words in the middle, if a word from the Torah is missing, the Torah is invalid. It doesn't matter whether you tuned out, you spaced out while davening the beginning, the middle, or the end. If you tuned out at any point, the entire prayer is missing because it's definitional to what prayer is. Kevan duhudin ha-nahug b'chol ha-mitzvot. U'kishar ha-mitzvot b'chol ha-mitzvot kula tzricha kavanah. A little bit of kavana here would not be sufficient. The entirety of the prayer needs kavana. Prayer is also more challenging than some other mitzvot, because most other mitzvot happen in a much more compressed time frame. Matzah, lulav, etc. You do the act, even though sometimes we draw it out, the act is done once you've sat in the sukkah. The act is done once you've swallowed the piece of matzah. But davening takes however many words there are. I'm still waiting for that answer. It takes however many minutes it takes to pray. So it's more conceivable to think of it as you had kavana for some and you didn't have kavana for others. V'zehu she'pasakein Rambam dehade bo'inen she'yedeh shehu omeid b'tfilah ma'akeh b'chol ha'tfilah kula. V'haynu mitrei ta'amei chade mishum de'balav ha'chi ha'le mitasek. The absence of the awareness that you're standing before God puts you in the category of mitasek. It's like picking up the broom to chase out the bird, and in fact, it wasn't a broom at all. It was a lulav. Picking up the kazoo to toot a few notes, and out came the right notes of the shofar. And oh, by accident, it wasn't a kazoo. It happened to have been a shofar. It's mitasek. You haven't fulfilled the obligation. Or a different case. You're the Baal Tokeya. You have to go to shul to blow the shofar. But it's a big responsibility. You wake up early in the morning. You couldn't sleep. So you want to practice before you go to shul. When you're practicing, you're just tooting around. And even though you're practicing the actual right notes, you don't have intent to fulfill your obligation. You have intent that all you're doing is, in fact, is practicing. You're not intending to fulfill the obligation. That's mitasek. You're asuk in practicing. And since you're involved in practicing, by definition, you're not aiming to actually do a mitzvah. So if you are lacking any awareness that you're communicating with the Shekhinah, so that puts you in the category of mitasek. V'od mishum din mitzvot svichot kavana. And further, since we say that in principle, mitzvot svichot kavana. D'tshavayhu ma'akvei b'chol ha'tfilah kemo b'chol ha'mitzvot. V'rak b'kavana terush ha'divarim d'hu din misuyam rak b'tfilah b'zehu d'kaimalan d'lo ma'akva rak b'vracha rishona. But the second category of prayer, knowing what you're saying, meaning knowing the explanation of the words, that is to be aspired to. But if one does not know all of the words of the prayer, meaning you can't explain them, you can't translate them in your head, so although one should have that for the entirety of the tefillah, minimally the first blessing is enough. Now this is a tricky thing because, you know, many of us pray on a regular basis. I'm guessing that none of us are native Hebrew speakers, but even native Hebrew speakers could theoretically and in reality be challenged by some of the vocabulary of the Amidah, because they're not all words that we are necessarily familiar with from everyday modern Hebrew. Think in your own heads of words. Some words are easier to understand because we can translate them. Some words are harder to understand because even if we can translate them, we may not be aware conceptually what it is that we're talking about. And then other words might just elude us altogether. So think of the words ta'aker utshaber utmager v'tachnia. Four synonyms, I guess, about what God should do to the bad guys. Those of you that pray on a regular basis, and those of you that pray in Hebrew on a regular basis, will be familiar with these words. Ta'aker u'tshaber u'tmager v'tachnia, or sa'aker u'tshaber u'tmager v'tachnia in Ashkenuzis. Well, do you know what those terms are? What are the four different... They're more or less synonyms. But what is the specificity of each of them? if you can't answer that, you should make a trip to your local Hebrew-English sitter and figure it out. And that's just one stitch of four words in the many hundreds of words, thousands of words in the Amidah. However, if one were to pray every day and say those words without having a clear sense of what they mean, you would fulfill your obligation, although not in the most elegant way. Because that is an awareness that one needs to have, an understanding of what one is saying. But it's not ma'akev. It doesn't prevent the fulfillment of the mitzvah if one has, in fact, performed it. However, the awareness that you're standing before God, that when you're saying these words, even though they may be words that you don't 100% fully understand, but nevertheless their recitation requires the awareness that you're standing before God, because that's the difference between taking an etrog and waving a tennis ball. It's definitional to the mitzvah. Now, this notion of the Trei Gavnei, or the Tzvei Dinim, the two categories of Kavanah, this is a very typical device or technique that Reb Chaim employs when trying to, so much so that it's almost a stereotype of itself, of what Brisker Lumdus is. Part of what Reb Chaim was doing in his analysis of the Rambam was to draw our attention to these apparent contradictions and to resolve them by showing that, well, it's not really a contradiction because, in fact, we're talking about two different things, and if we were to only classify them properly in our understanding, we would understand, of course, that there is no contradiction in the Rambam, a notion that was antithetical to Reb Chaim's worldview, the idea that there would be a contradiction within the Rambam. This is perhaps one of the most famous employments of this technique. In Yiddish, it's called the Tzvei Dinim, or the two halachot, or the two components, or the Trei Gavnei, the two sides to the coin. That there's kavanah that's specific to tefillah, which means knowing the words, and that's not required in the entirety, although it's to be strived for. And then there's the kavanah of the definition of what mitzvot are. Every mitzvah has its own definition, and if one attempts to perform the mitzvah absent that definition, then ipso facto you have not fulfilled the mitzvah. I remember years ago checking a particular mezuzah only to find out that the scroll inside was in fact not a scroll at all. It was just a piece of rolled up paper. The mezuzah, the case, was very lovely, and it had hung on whatever door this was for very, very, very many years. But in fact, it was not a mezuzah at all. Because if you just wrap up a piece of paper, what I suspect is that the person that hung this mezuzah got it as a gift, and it came with this little rolled up piece of paper there, I guess, as like a demonstration of where the mezuzah scroll should go. And it got hung up by accident, but one way or another, it's by definition not a mezuzah as nice as the ceramic or metal or whatever case hanging on the door is. By definition, every mitzvah has its own definition. In every legal system, there's an attempt to lay out clear definitions. If we're going to say that this act is against the law, there needs to be a clear definition. Drunk driving is against the law. But what is the definition of drunk? It can't mean that anyone that sipped an alcoholic beverage is drunk. It can't mean that somebody who is drunk now can't drive indefinitely. there needs to be a clear definition. So in the meantime, the clear definition has something to do with blood alcohol level. They take a test, they know how much blood is in your system. Obviously, a big, heavy, burly guy can probably drink more liquor and be unaffected than a small, petite, young lady. So it has something to do with the proportion of alcohol in your blood. There, but there has to be some kind of clear definition. I recall having a series of, I'll say, debates with a particular psychiatrist acquaintance. He would say things like, Sobzman Kriyat Shema, the last time to recite Shema. Let's say it's at 8:39 in the morning. Do you think God is sitting there with a stopwatch and he cares whether you say it at 8:37 or at 8:41? So I would, you know, try to bait him and say something like, well, it probably doesn't matter, but it probably also doesn't matter whether you prescribe, you know, 40 milligrams or 60 milligrams of the drug, because really doesn't really matter. And they, that's different. It's science. And my response was, correct, it's science. But halakha, just like science, has its own very, very precise definitions. And every mitzvah has its own definition. The definition of prayer is awareness throughout the entirety that you are standing in the presence of God. Now, like I said, not everyone agrees with Reb Chaim. The Chazon Ish, the great leader of the what's today called the Haredi Jewish world in Israel, the great Posek, wrote a series of commentaries, comments on Reb Chaim's work. And in this particular place, he says that, you know, it can't be, because although it's an ideal that we should all strive for, it basically means that no one ever davens, that no one ever could possibly fulfill davening. It set the bar so high. And the Chazon Ish says something more akin to what I said earlier, that we're talking about l'chatchila and b'dieved, that although we should all strive for full kavana minimally, if we can muster it for the first bracha, the Shulchan Aruch also seems to suggest that kavana for the paragraph modim, more towards the end of the prayer, the Thanksgiving portion of the prayer, is also desirable. A higher level of kavana is desirable, but whatever the practical halacha is, it can't be that if you tune out for one word, it invalidates the whole thing. But nevertheless, that's what Reb Chaim says. Next week, having laid down this groundwork for the centrality of kavana in prayer, we'll begin to unravel the Rub's take on this, because in some places he seems to be walking in his grandfather's footsteps, and in others he seems to be striking out on new ground, which was one of the interesting things about Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, his ability to both carry on the family tradition, but yet also to be creative and innovative and to not be afraid of putting forth his own ideas. So next week we'll do that. Perhaps we'll all already get into that chapter that I made available to you, which I recommend from that volume. Here it is, Worship of the Heart, Essays on Jewish Prayer, by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, edited by Rabbi Shalom Carmi, available in various places. We've discussed that. So we'll continue next week. As always, I welcome your feedback and comments, and I'll stay online for another few minutes if anyone has any questions, or maybe I'll answer some of these chats that came in that I didn't have a chance to, and I welcome your thoughts as we go along.